Got an email from Richard asking about microcap funds. Gonna answer that. Gonna have a tool. Gonna have a guru coming up on the Mad Money Machine. Mad Money Machine. Show 83. Middle of October. Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Mad Money Machine. My name is Paul Douglas Boyer. And coming up on this show, we're going to talk a little bit. We're going to school and talk about microcap stocks, what it means, what their funds and ETFs are, what performance there is, why you want to get invested in some of these things. We'll talk about Index Funds Advisors because this show is proud to be sponsored by Index Funds Advisors at IFA.com. And we'll also talk about the new for 2007 True Triple Buy stock. Yeah, back on show number 5, I had a triple buy pick that has performed stellarly since that time. And so we're going to use that same methodology to pick a new stock. I'll have a tool in the crib. I'll have a guru for you. I'll talk about miscellaneous things. So let's get right to it. Right now, I'm looking at an ad on the Fox Business Channel for the OneTouchJar.com, and it is a battery-operated gizmo that clamps down on a jar and then automatically removes the lid. You don't do anything. It clamps down on the jar and removes the lid. Boy, there are so many options for removing lids from jars these days, aren't there? You would think that removing a lid from a jar was the hardest problem in the world to solve. It's one of the most significant crises that we face in our homes. You know we're living in good times when the most serious crisis we face in our homes is how do we remove the lid from our spaghetti sauce jar? Well, I was looking to see what Fox's Business Channel was going to do in response to CNBC's Mad Money. You know, the Fox Business Channel started this week, and for a minute there, I thought I didn't get it, but it turns out, yeah, on Verizon Fios, it comes in for me on channel 94. It's not in the guide listings yet, and they don't actually have a guide showing what shows come on and when. I imagine they'll be changing things around rapidly as they try to find their market for viewers. But at the moment, the show that comes on at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, it's called Happy Hour, and they actually film it in a bar. And so what better mixture of money and alcohol to provide us with the answers that we need for our investments? Then at 6, I believe it's Neil Cavuto going up against head-to-head with Jim Cramer's Mad Money. And then at 8 o'clock, one of the top podcasts in the iTunes business category, Dave Ramsey, is now on TV in addition to his radio shows. I haven't watched one of his shows yet. In fact, I haven't watched one of the Cavuto shows yet, but that's what they say that they show. So many channels, so little time. Well, are you ready? Let's take a little peek and see how Jumpin' Jimmy's Stocks of the Year have performed so far in 2007. You remember at the beginning of January, Jim came out in 3 successive shows talking about his 3 value companies, his 3 growth companies, and his 3 speculation companies. In value, it's MO, which is Altria, then Halliburton, and Goldman Sachs. In growth, Apple, Cisco, and NYSE Euronext. And speculation, Savian Pharmaceuticals, Rite Aid, and Level 3. So if you had invested equally in a portfolio of all 9 of these stocks, how much would your gain be as of Tuesday, October the 16th? Well, first of all, let's look at the index folio returns. Index folio 100 is up 9.42%. And if you had instead picked these Cramer stocks, before I tell you the entire portfolio return, let's look at one of the big winners in there, Apple. At the time he recommended it, Apple was trading at $85.77. It is currently trading at $153.95 for a gain of 79.5%. So you must think that this portfolio of stocks is going to be way up there, right? Well, if you'd have put all your money in Apple, you might have done well. But what about Level 3 Communications? It was $6.18. Now it's $4.65 for a loss of 24.8%. How about that Rite Aid stock of the year? It was at $5.79. Now it's at $4.62 for a loss of 20.2%. NYSE Euronext. It was at $96.40, and now it's $79.95, a loss of 17.6%. So overall, an equally weighted portfolio of the nine stocks, including the spinoff of Kraft, by the way, it would be, if you'd have put $100,000 in at the beginning, it'd be worth $110,581 for a gain of 10.5%. So you have gained 1% more than the index folio 100 as of this point. Is it really worth it? Is it worth your time? Is it worth the anguish of knowing that you hold Level 3 Communications down 24.8%? Oh, maybe it is, because it's worth such the thrill. You can tell all your friends at the parties, hey, I own some Apple computer and it went up 79%. That's the way these party conversations typically go, I think. You always hear about the winners in the portfolio, but you don't hear about the entire portfolio performance, and maybe you don't hear about the losers, although that would be good party talk too, wouldn't it? But just like we'll talk about when we talk about microcap stocks a little bit later, there's a correlation between risk and return. Investing in these individual stocks increases the amount of risk that you're taking, but it also has specific company risk, which when you invest in a broadly diversified basket of individual stocks, you tend to diminish the impact of specific company risk to a great degree, and you're left with just the risk of the entire market, the risk of capitalism. Investing in individual stocks, yeah, you've got the higher risk of the market and of capitalism in that one stock, but you also have the risk specific to that company, which is a risk that doesn't reward you. So higher risk, same amount of return, sounds pretty dumb to me. I was thumbing through the high definition channels in my new Verizon Fios cable, came across VH1's Rock Honors, and they were having tributes to Ozzy Osbourne and Genesis and Heart. And before each actual recipient came to play on the show, they had a tribute band come and play one of their songs. And for Heart, it was a combination of Alice in Chains and Gretchen Wilson, the country singer. And I've got to tell you, it was the stellar performance of the evening. And of course, you can find it on YouTube. You can find it at rock.vh1.com if you dig down deep enough. But it's easier to see it on YouTube. I'll have a link to it in the show notes of this show. And here's a little sampler of Barracuda by Alice in Chains and Gretchen Wilson. I think that's a better performance than Heart ever did, even in their heyday. I saw Heart perform in the Huntington, West Virginia Civic Center some 80 years ago, I guess it was, back in their thinner days. But that was a great performance by Gretchen Wilson. Wow, she should release that as a iTunes single. All right, let's turn our attention now to something that we don't like to talk about too much on this show, and that is individual stocks. If you go, if you know the history of the Mad Money Machine, you know that this started out as sort of a Jim Cramer validation show where I would look at his individual stock picks and grade them and see how much money we could make looking at individual stocks. And of course, as it turns out, index investing is the way to go, not picking individual stocks. Nonetheless, on show number five, way back in the Mad Money Machine archives, is called The True Triple Buy Stock. And that was back in on January 13th, 2006. And what I did is, back in the day, I had a subscription to that silly computer printout called the Investor's Business Daily. And they have on Mondays their 100 top IBD stocks. And I looked through that list. And at the same time, I had also finished that book, The Little Book That Beats the Market, which talked about some value formula that you use to pick stocks. And there's a website, magicformulainvesting.com, where you can put in market capitalization and number of stocks you want to see. And it comes back with the list at that time of the most undervalued stocks that you should buy. So I mashed those two together. And what I found one stock or a couple of stocks that were on both of those lists. And then I also then took those common stocks and went to see what Jim Cramer thought about those stocks. And there was one stock back in January of 2006 that popped out that was on the IBD list of top 100. It was on the Magic Formula Investing list of top 100. And it was on Jim Cramer's bye-bye-bye list. And you know what that is if you've been with me for any time. And if you don't know what it is, it's a stock that since that time, in a bit more than a year, I guess a year and three quarters, it has gone from $30.07 to $133.10. That's a 343% gain, 133% annualized. And it is ticker symbol PCU, Southern Copper Corporation. And I actually own some of Southern Copper Corporation, so you know I'm feeling the joy about that particular stock, because I think I owned it back in that at that time. That's not to say that there haven't been occasions where I've sold parts of it thinking that it's gone up too high and it just keeps going up, confounding any prediction power that I might have. So I thought, you know, let's try that trick again. If that worked so well, a 343% gain on a true triple buy stock, that's pretty good. Let's try it again. And so I went, I don't have that silly IBD subscription anymore. That costs too much. And I really hated that newspaper because it really is nothing more than a computer printout. And I went to the library where they have a subscription to it. And last Monday's paper, I went in, took a notebook, and wrote down all 100 ticker symbols that they have in their top 100 list, and brought it home, went online to Magic Formula Investing, pulled up not only the smallest companies, but some larger companies, so I had a list of more than 100, maybe 150, 170 ticker symbols in there, mashed the two together, and for a moment there, I thought I had a unique one. ACN was on the Magic Formula list, and I actually misread the one from the IBD list, ACM. And I was all excited because I thought, hey, ACN, that's great, which was Accenture. And it turns out, oh, no, it was a typo, ACM. So that was not a triple buy stock. But there was one stock that's on that list. It is a triple buy stock. It's a stock that is in the IBD 100 last Monday. It is in the Magic Formula Investing list. And I looked it up on thestreet.com, madmoney.com. Or there is no madmoney.com. Thestreet.com's Mad Money website. And Jim Cramer has, in fact, said it's a buy. So this is a true triple buy stock. And let me tell you what the ticker symbol on it is. Are you ready? Get a pencil. Write this down. PCU. Same stock. Southern Copper Corporation is still, a year and a half, year and three quarters later, is still the true triple buy stock on these lists. So it's incredible. After a huge run of 343% since that time, could it go up 343% again? Well, I sure hope so, since I own some of it. But I don't have the power of prediction, unfortunately, so I don't really know. I don't put a whole lot of faith in buying individual stocks. The problem is, when do you sell this silly thing? Do I sell it when I need the money, or do I sell it sometime where I identify the company's in crisis and I should sell, therefore it makes sense for me to pay all the capital gains taxes on this stock now? I hate that decision. I hate it so much more than just buying an index fund and selling it when I need the money. Not having to make a decision about whether a company's in crisis or whether the economy is going to turn down on that particular sector of the market or something. Oh, anyway. So there you have it, this week's True Triple Buy Stock. Did I mention I got my Xbox back from the repair facility in Texas? I think I did. Several weeks ago, about a month or so ago. Been playing a little bit of Guitar Hero every now and then, although I am really up against a wall of my capabilities in it. I have got half of the hard songs to get to 5 stars on, and I don't think I've got any of the extreme songs at 5 stars. So it's something you really got to spend a lot of time on, and I just want to have fun with it. Don't want to become expert in Guitar Hero, I guess. But I also have picked up a copy of Halo 3. And the other thing I don't do much of is play it in multiplayer. Now, I've heard the multiplayer is actually the way to play Halo. I'm kind of intimidated, actually. I don't have a good buddy, a real good buddy, who has Halo 3 that can call me, I can call him, and say, hey, let's hook up online, get into a death match or something. I'm kind of intimidated just to play with a stranger at this point. Here's a tip for guys my size, and I know there's a lot of you out there. Because when I go shoe shopping, oh, there's plenty of size 10s and 11s and 12s all over the place. There's size 7s and 6s even. But woe to the guy with a size 9 foot. Woe to the guy. Because if you don't get there when the truck arrives, there aren't any in the stores for you to buy. Well, so I know that you're my size. Here's a tip. You know how your socks don't fit? The heel on your sock goes way back up on your ankle when you put it on. Because socks, there isn't a size for socks, apparently. It's just men's socks. And it says on the package, fits shoe size, 5 to 40. And it's always been kind of an annoying thing that I have to wear the same size sock as some guy with this gargantuan foot. Well, I have swallowed my pride. And last time I was at Costco, I bought a package of white Crew women's socks, thank you, and they fit gloriously. It's the most comfortable sock that I think I've ever owned. The heel finds its place on my foot where the heel should be, where the heel is. The heel matches up to my heel. And I have also gone out and bought a pair of the low-cut women's white socks that I use for my running occasions, and they fit just perfectly. So there's my tip this week for guys my size. Buy women's socks. I'd like to reach down into the toolbox and pull something out this week. And this one's kind of a half-hearted suggestion. It's not something that I think is fantastic. All right? And I'm allowed to do that, aren't I? I mean, I have given you something that I think is fantastic. That SMF Excel plugin. I think that's fantastic. This one, it's all right. It's a website. Or you could plug it into your feed reader, although, it's one of those annoying feeds where they don't give you the entire story. You get the headline of the story in your feed reader, and then you got to click on it and go to their website in order to read the whole thing. I find that summary posting annoying. But anyway, it's a place for actual good information, and it is the website called indexuniverse.com. And on their About Us page, it says, Index Universe encompasses the world of indexing and beyond. Our website and related sub-sites cover product and market development related to index funds, exchange-traded funds, index derivatives, and the sophisticated investment strategies which use these financial tools. Our goal is to provide the industry's best news, columns, research, and features about the dynamic field of index-based investing and trading. And they have columns and quotes and, of course, advertisements and other trade publications. There was one article dated Thursday, November 1st, 2007. And today being October the 18th, I find this wonderfully prescient that they can tell what's going to happen on November 1st. The article is entitled International Small Cap, a Distinct Asset Class. And it's a long article, typical of what you'd find in the Journal of Indexes, talking about this very fact of international small cap stocks. I have talked a little bit about my ownership of the DLS, which I don't own anymore, unfortunately. It's done well. But it talks about the issue of correlation between these international small cap stocks and other indices like the U.S. indexes or the other world indexes, and says that these international small cap class doesn't correlate as well, which is good. That's what you want. You want non-correlating assets. And you can read all about that in their conclusions. Index Universe is where I found out that the iShares is going to come out with this Emerging Market Small Cap Value ETF, which I am eager to see. So there's my half-hearted tool tip for this week is indexuniverse.com. Go check it out. Read some articles. See if it's interesting to you. Put it in your bookmarks if you like it. Subscribe to their feed if you like it. Unlike all the other tools I've given you so far, this one's only partly free. Let's play a round of the world's favorite game, Guru Roulette. I've replaced the numbers on a roulette wheel with the names of investment gurus. I'll spin the wheel and roll the marble, and for the selected guru, give you a little background on their investment philosophy. So here we go. And the winner this time on Mad Men Machine Show 83 is Tim Harford. Well, you may not have heard of Tim Harford, but he writes the Financial Times magazine Dear Economist column, in which he draws upon the latest economic theories to provide tongue-in-cheek answers to readers' personal dilemmas. And most notably, he's written a book called The Undercover Economist, which I'm about halfway through. And there was something that I thought was particularly interesting. Chapter number 2, entitled What Supermarkets Don't Want You to Know. And he talks about your typical Starbucks-like coffee shop. In this case, he talks about one called Costa Coffee, which is in London. He talks about how Costa Coffee has this exclusive piece of property near the London Eye, that big Ferris wheel-like thing. It's the only coffee store nearby. And he asks, but how should Costa exploit the scarcity they are renting from the London Eye? They could simply raise the price of a cappuccino from about $3 to nearly $6. Some people would pay it, but many would not. Alternatively, they could cut prices and sell much more coffee. They could cover wages and ingredients by charging as little as $1 a cup. But unless they're able to increase their sales dozens of times over, they'd not make enough to cover the rent. That's the dilemma. Higher margins per cup, but fewer cups, or lower margins on more cups. It would be nice for Costa to sidestep that dilemma by charging a dollar to people who are not willing to pay more, and $6 to people who are willing to pay a lot to enjoy the coffee and the view. That way they'd have the high margins whenever they could get them and still sell coffee at a small profit to the skinflints. But how to do it? Have a price list saying, cappuccino, $6, unless you're only willing to pay a dollar. He doubts that that would catch on, he says. And then Tim Harford talks about how Costa hit upon an elegant strategy. Like most other coffee bars these days, they offer something called Fair Trade Coffee that comes from a leading brand called Cafe Direct. For several years, customers who wished to support third world farmers, and such customers are apparently not uncommon in London, were charged an extra 18 cents or so. They may have believed that the money went to the struggling coffee farmer. The evidence suggested that almost none of the money went anywhere but Costa's bottom line. Charging an extra 18 cents gave a misleading impression of how much it really cost to get a hold of that fair trade coffee. Costa later abandoned the premium of fair trade coffee because it was bad public relations, not because it was unprofitable. He says, "Any well-run business would seek to charge each customer the maximum price he'd be willing to pay, and they do. Take a Starbucks, any Starbucks. The price list would look like this: hot chocolate $2.20, cappuccino $2.55, cafe mocha $2.75, white chocolate mocha $3.20, 20-ounce cappuccino $3.40. Or to translate, hot chocolate, no frills $2.20, cappuccino, no frills $2.55. Mix them together, I feel special $2.75. Use different powder, I feel very special $3.20. Make it huge, I feel greedy $3.40. Starbucks isn't merely seeking to offer a variety of alternatives to customers. It's also trying to give the customer every opportunity to signal that they've not been looking at the price. Does it cost much more to make a larger cup, to use a flavored syrup, or to add chocolate powder or a squirt of whipped cream? Every single product on the menu above costs Starbucks almost the same to produce, down to the odd nickel or two. Does this mean that Starbucks is overcharging all of its customers? No. If so, a regular cappuccino or a hot chocolate would cost $3.30. And you could have all the frills you wanted for a dime. Perhaps Starbucks would like to do that, but they can't force price-sensitive customers to pay those prices. By charging wildly different prices for products that have largely the same cost, Starbucks is able to smoke out customers who are less sensitive about the price. Starbucks doesn't have a way to identify lavish customers perfectly, so it invites them to hang themselves with a choice of luxurious ropes. And he goes on to talk about examples from the grocery store and examples of two of the same grocery stores walking distance apart, not charging the same amount. I guess I've always looked at prices from my perspective in that I wanted to pay as little as I can. I've never really looked at it from the perspective of an owner of a Starbucks and how much he should charge for a cup of coffee. But now it makes perfect sense. Well, I encourage you to pick up a copy of Tim Harford's The Undercover Economist. I got mine from the library. The subtitle is Exposing Why the Rich Are Rich, the Poor Are Poor, and You Can Never Buy a Decent Used Car. Congratulations, Tim Harford. You're the guru on Mad Men Machine Show 83. Continuing our talks now with Mark Hebner from his podcast about the 12-step program. Mark has the book, of course, Index Funds, a 12-step program for active investors. Mark, in your book, you've had commissioned a number of paintings that I think are great, by the way, that detail the various levels of risk capacity. Could you tell us a little bit about them and what they mean to our listeners?
Well, we had a lot of people taking our risk capacity survey that came up with risk levels that really were not appropriate for them. And it occurred to me that it might be helpful if I commissioned an artist to do sort of a movie poster style painting that captured the type of investor that should end up with these various scores. So for example, if you're a 25-year-old with a $250,000 already saved up in your portfolio and you have a good solid income and you enjoy extreme sports and like to take risks, and you take my survey and you end up with a portfolio 5 and you look at the painting and it looks like your grandma and grandpa, then you'll realize that maybe you answered some of the questions incorrectly, or you made some choices that may not be the best thing for you. And so these paintings help sort of characterize the various risk levels or life cycle period for different investors. And I think our artist, Lala Ragimov, did a great job in sort of mixing together both the colors that represent the various risk levels, as well as the time period in your life. One interesting fact I like about these paintings is they start off with the sun rising at the highest risk level, which are for the youngest investors. And over the 20 portfolios, you can slowly see the sun transition across the top to when you get to portfolio five at the lowest risk level, you see the sun setting. This is sort of the cycle of life and the cycle of risk that investors would be best advised to take in their investing.
Okay, so we have to make sure that the picture matches our risk level as well. Is this the type of assessment that someone should take regularly, routinely, or is it just a one-time thing?
Well, because you go through different cycles in your life, every year or every couple years, investors should sort of retest their risk capacity. The other thing we find is when we go through jolts in the market, big declines in the market, people often get sort of tested on their questions, like how much are you willing to hang on to in market drops? For example, we'll ask them, you know, could you stand a 25% drop in your portfolio and not sell? Well, it's one thing for investors to, you know, just select an answer. It's another thing for them to actually experience these market declines. And so we find these are good times also in periods of decline for investors to sort of retest their ability to hang on to their portfolio. But I might add, the more knowledge they have about long-term historic returns, about the fact that they're just investing in capitalism, and that over 10 years, all of these bad markets tend to smooth out because capitalism works and ultimately the market comes back. All of these things help strengthen investors so that these short-term returns don't scare them out of their portfolio.
Thanks so much, Mark. For more information and sources on today's material, log on to ifa.com, and there, of course, you can take this risk capacity survey and see for yourself what it all means. And you know what? At the end of the risk capacity survey now, when you fill in your email address, you will be given a free e-copy of the book, The 12-Step Program for Active Investors, all about index funds. And it's a must-read for any investor. Turning now into MLS soccer news, I have just finished watching the LA Galaxy versus New York Red Bulls match Thursday, October 18th. It's 1 in the morning Eastern time. And you can tell that now because I hear the buzz. If you're listening to this on your iPod, you can hear that little buzz. That's the front porch lights that are fluorescent lights that cause that buzz. Forgot to turn it off. And what a tense game that was. LA trying to score. LA did score in the 16th minute. And then New York came immediately back and scored to tie it up. And LA trying to score to win the match throughout the rest of the game. No score. Ended at the tie. 1-1. Each team getting a point moves LA's chances for a playoff down just a little bit. They need Kansas City to actually lose their match, not tie, against FC Dallas this coming Saturday at 8:30 p.m. And then, of course, LA needs to win against the Chicago Fire Sunday, October 21st, 3 p.m. Now, my schedule says that that match will be shown on Telefutura. What is that? I don't have Telefutura on my cable TV. Surely if Kansas City loses on Saturday, someone will pick up the match and show it so that we can see that on Sunday. I'm hoping so. David Beckham did make it into the match in the last 15 or 20 minutes. Took three or four or five corner kicks, and otherwise looked healthy, played healthy, didn't favor ankle or knee, and so we'll be looking forward to great things from him going forward. All right, now back to your regularly scheduled Mad Money Machine. That basically is it for the main content of the show. Now, this last part of the show is optional for many of you listeners. I'm going to get in depth and talk about microcap funds. I've got a letter from Richard I'm going to read. Talk about microcap fund options. So you can either skip it or not. There's nothing else after that. See you next week. But don't go before you visit our sponsors at indexfundsadvisors@ifa.com. Got an email from Richard, and I'll read it to you. It says, Paul, I've been listening to your shows through the entire series. Wow. I don't know if you realize it, but in the MBA program at University of California, Irvine, they made pretty much the point that indexing was the best way to go for long-term investments. The points you bring out that most active managers don't beat the market is the key point brought out in the MBA program. Other things that are brought out are portfolio theory, Sharpe ratio, risk, standard deviation, etc. Asset allocation is the key to performance, and that is what I believe is being done by the selection of various indexes to optimize for current conditions. I just downloaded your new tool from the crib. Remember a couple shows ago, the automatic portfolio returns spreadsheet using the stock market functions plugin? Looks like it provides an allocation of ETFs to approximate the returns of the IFA Index Folio 100. Yeah, you remember the I kind of modeled some iShares and some Vanguard ETFs in there, trying to match up the Index Folio 100. Richard writes, though, one important asset class that's missing from the other portfolios, the comparable to the U.S. microcap stock market index. I'm curious, what is the criteria for a company to be in the microcap universe? Thanks, Richard. Well, thank you, Richard, for writing in. And let's talk a little bit about investing in microcap companies. Why do we want to do this? Well, if you have studied the works of Eugene Fama and Kenneth French, you will know that they believe that markets are efficient, and that you should invest in index funds, secondly, and that over the course of all of history in stocks, they have determined that you get rewarded for the risks that you take, basically. And they then lead to the conclusion that smaller companies are riskier and value-y companies are riskier. That is, companies that have a low price to its book ratio. These are sometimes companies that have been gone through a little bit of trouble and their stock prices have come down, right? So the price of the stock is relatively low compared to the value of the company. Or said another way, a high book-to-market value. It's a value stock. Fama and French postulated then that small value is the highest risk and therefore would give the higher return. Risk and return are indeed correlated. That's why we look at putting a portion of our investments into microcap and small cap value stocks. In fact, if you look at the IFA Index Folio 100, their riskiest portfolio, you will see that they recommend putting 20% of your portfolio into a U.S. microcap index, and then another 20% into U.S. small cap value index. Of course, note that the Index Folio 100 is the most risky of the 20 portfolios. Most of the other portfolios of the equity portion, they recommend 10% microcap and 10% small cap value. And then it's just a matter of tweaking how much bonds you own. So what is microcap then? In the DFA case, in the DFA U.S. microcap portfolio, here's what they say. They say that that portfolio is a no-load mutual fund designed to capture the returns and diversification benefits of a broad cross-section of U.S. small-cap companies on a market cap-weighted basis. The portfolio generally invests in securities of U.S. companies whose size, based primarily on market capitalization, falls within the smallest 5% of the market universe. These are the smallest of the small, the 5% smallest of all companies on the stock exchanges. The market universe, in fact, is comprised of those on the New York Stock Exchange, American Stock Exchange, and the NASDAQ market system. So that is the definition of microcap. Now, what's the difference between that and a small cap value? The DFA US small cap value portfolio, it's a no-load mutual fund, and it captures the returns and diversification benefits of a broad cross-section of U.S. small-value companies on a market cap-weighted basis. Now here, the portfolio invests in securities of U.S. companies whose size falls within the smallest 10% of the market universe. The market universe is comprised of companies listed on the New York Stock Exchange, American Stock Exchange, and NASDAQ. After identifying the 10% of aggregate market capitalization, a value screen is applied to this universe. Securities are considered value stocks primarily because a company's shares have a high book value in relation to their market value, or BTM, book to market. This book to market sort excludes firms with negative or zero book values in assessing value. Additional factors such as price to cash flow or price to earnings ratios may be considered, as well as economic conditions and developments in the issuer's industry. The criteria for assessing value are subject to change from time to time, of course. DFA is unique in that sector, in that their index funds have a little shade of active management to them in that sense. Or more specifically stated, they're kind of like a quant fund. They're quantitatively looking at a value screen for stocks that fit that portfolio. And what I've done out at the MadMoneyMachine.com website in the show notes for this show is I've put a table of some micro cap mutual funds and exchange traded funds that are worth looking at. And I've divided them up into USA specific stock funds and international stock funds. And for each ticker symbol, I have the name of the fund, the price to book ratio, the average market cap of the stocks in that fund, the expense ratio, the number of companies or the number of stocks that are held by that fund, the amount of assets invested in that fund in millions, the turnover ratio, the annual turnover percentage, how much of the portfolio is turned over every year. This makes a difference in taxable accounts. And the approximate dividend yield. Now, many of these figures come from Morningstar, and they're updated either as of September, the end of September, or in some cases, the end of June. So starting with the USA funds, what I've done is sorted these from smallest average market cap size to largest average market cap size. And coming in at the smallest then for the USA funds is the PowerShares Zacks Microcap Fund, PZI is the ticker symbol. The average market cap size of companies in this fund, there are 399 companies, the average size is $327 million. Price-to-book ratio is a respectably small 1.4. This gives you a kind of a feel as to how valuey is this fund. There's only $166 million worth of assets invested in this fund, and it has an unusually high percentage of turnover ratio, 72% turned over in this fund. Of course, small and microcap funds, you would expect there's going to be a bit of a larger turnover in microcap funds just due to the nature of some companies either failing or trying to keep the amount of companies in the fund that's needed. And of course, a company may grow to be too big for the fund eventually, and it would need to be sold. Coming in second place in the average market cap size, just a bit ahead of PowerShares X Microcap, is the Bridgeway Ultra Small Company Market, BRSIX is the ticker symbol there. Average market cap size is $362 million. Price to book is a little bit higher, though, 2.2. It has an expense ratio of 0.67%. The number of companies in that fund are 567, a little larger, and a much larger number of assets invested in that fund at $1,101,000,000. Turnover ratio 34%. And you'll get the idea by looking at the rest of the table. Some of the other interesting funds in there, the iShares Russell Microcap Index, IWC, is next. The RIDEX S&P Small Cap 600 Pure Value. Now, this one's interesting because it has the lowest price-to-book ratio at 1.2. This is as value-y as you can get. If you're looking for small value, this is the one. But it only has 166 companies in it, and it has the least amount of assets invested of any USA fund. It had only $23 million invested in this fund. Turnover ratio so far is respectively low, 7%, and an unusually high dividend yield of 1.69% for a fund of this type. And looking at the Vanguard fund, the VBR, Vanguard Small Cap Value, it is the second highest in the list that I've pulled out at $1.639 billion market cap average. It has a 1.8 price-to-book ratio. Expense ratio is notable here, though. It is the lowest of all of the funds in its expense ratio at 0.12%. It's invested in 936 companies, and it has the largest amount of assets invested in it at $5.456 billion. Let's turn now to the international microcap funds. The smallest fund is The smallest average microcap size invested by one of these funds is the DFA, International Small Company Fund, ticker symbol DFISX. Its price-to-book ratio is 1.8, has an expense ratio of 0.56, and it has about $5.5 billion invested in it. And then we get to the Wisdom Tree funds, the DFE, the Wisdom Tree Europe Small Cap Dividend Fund, market cap of about $1 billion, and the Wisdom Tree International Small Cap Dividend, DLS, is $1.2 billion market cap. Expense ratios on these are respectable, 0.58%. The Europe Fund invests in 383 companies, and the International Fund invests in 677 companies. Now, what's going to be interesting to watch in this category is the new iShares Emerging Market Small Cap ETF, which I've talked about. That's coming soon, and I'll be looking out for that one. Well, you can see all the details about these and pick one or two for your microcap asset allocation. This is Paul Douglas Boyer saying it takes money to make money, and it takes looking in the microscope to make a mad money machine. I will see you in a few days, maybe next week. In the meantime, visit our sponsor, IFA.com. Take their risk capacity survey, benchmark your portfolio, and do take a look at that DFA microcap fund. Thanks for joining me. Some music on this show provided by music.podshow.com. I'd appreciate your feedback through email at feedback@madmoneymachine.com or the voicemail line 206-734-4763, and visit the website madmoneymachine.com. I'll see you next week.